Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport, on and off the field. I'm your host, Liseli Satali, and today I'm really excited to introduce today's guest, as she's a woman who's incredibly accomplished and has a lot of interesting projects to talk through, and probably has some of the most demanding sort of job titles in her everyday life. It's the absolutely impressive Anouk Mertens, who is the managing director of Neo Studios and the COO of 11 Sport. Hi there, Anouk. How are you doing?
Hi. How are you? Nice to meet you.
I'm well. Yeah, no, it's awesome to have you on here. Thank you very much for making the time in what I know is an incredibly demanding schedule that you normally have.
I think we all have in these times on Zoom calls, yes.
Yeah, definitely. But I feel more so if you happen to be the managing director and the COO of two incredibly, you know, fast growing companies. So, you know, just to sort of dive in there so people can get a little bit of an understanding. How did you get into the sort of roles that you're doing here? And what is it that you love about working within the sports industry?
So currently I'm, as you said, the CEO of 11 Sports Group. I joined 11 Sports over five years ago, right at the beginning. And they approached me while they were setting up a business in Belgium and Luxembourg, and we're actually looking for somebody to, you know, start from scratch. And at that time, I was wrapping up my previous job and actually wanted to take some time off and to reflect and enjoy life and travel a bit. But the prospect seemed very interesting, and it was a new company with lots of ambition. And I said, "Well, great! I'll join you. I'll start up the business." And I have never left.
Amazing, and
I think it was a very exciting time. It's a typical, you know, startup mentality, a very flat organization, a shareholder with a lot of vision, and it was really fun to start the Belgian Luxembourg business. Yeah. Done that three years, and then obviously at that time, 11 Sports is a very ambitious company, started growing multiple territories, and Belgium was kind of running. The team was there, we had the contracts in place, we were doing good, was profitable. So that's when I moved to a group level, and our CEO at the time, Mark Watson, said, "Well, we could use some expertise at the group level for somebody who has actually done for us setting up a company, because we're setting up much more territories." And that's why I joined as a COO, mainly looking at how to, you know, get new territories up and running, the ones that we had, to make sure that you know, we look for synergies across the group, and drive them a bit quicker to profitability, ideally. So that was my role within the group. And 11 and Acer, because we are part of the Acer Venture Group, wouldn't be who we are, and to tell you we are, that there are lots of new projects, new opportunities that arise. And so over a year ago, I think it's maybe slightly longer, when Andrea, who is the owner of Acer Venture, who owns as well Leeds United Football Club, said, "Wouldn't it be a cool idea to do a documentary series?" And I said, like, "Yeah, that sounds interesting." And that's basically how I rolled into, you know, started doing a documentary series, and based on that, starting up a production company within the Acer Group, and currently combining the two of them, building very much that Neo Studios business, that production business, because I believe there is a big potential as well. But so that's how I ended up with two jobs currently.
How you ended up with two jobs currently. Amazing. So I think just sort of to take it back a little bit for some people who might not be so familiar, because we have a bit of an international audience on the podcast. That's 11 Sport, if it hasn't reached where you are yet, is a sports streaming service that essentially is a new age broadcaster that came in and is a real challenger in the market space in terms of how you reimagine how fans access and experience sport. So quite similar to my normal day job in broadcasting mm-hmm. as well. And obviously you mentioned there that part of the, you know, the role and the kind of vision there that you have with Andrea Razziani, who obviously owns Asa Group, is to bring all these kind of brands together within the sports media space to sort of work in harmony with each other and to try and grow them faster, right? How do you, in your role as the chief operations officer of these two kind of businesses, one which is really dealing in the live sports side of things, mm-hmm. and then the other which is kind of dealing a lot in, and we're going to go on to talk about the really brilliant series that you created up around Leeds United, which was shown on Amazon Prime called Take Us Home. How do you square the challenges of trying to move really fast with a live streaming service and growing it at scale versus, you know, trying to get obviously a really good production company there to establish it and have it in that creative mold that you would like? How do you balance that challenge?
Yeah, I think my job at 11 Sports is, and 11 Sports obviously is all about live content. That's our bread and butter. That's why we exist. And looking at the growth within the group and the focus on, you know, getting those rights and keeping those rights, making them interesting, tailoring them to a local audience, which is important. And that's also the reason why we have, you know, dedicated local teams in each country that we are active in to make sure we really get that connection with the local fan, not only in language but also culturally. And building that live offering is very much on focus for me. Obviously, last few months have been extremely difficult for everybody working in live sports, with live sports.
Definitely.
for a while. But that also learned, was quite of an interesting experience within the group, because if you're focusing on, you know, live sports only and all of that goes away, then it's time to pause and to think and to reflect on, you know, what is it, what we do, what do we need to do, and how do we move forward. And the good thing is that we are a young company with lots of young and creative people, so really start thinking about what can we offer our customers, what do we need to add to a typical live experience. So we started focusing a lot on doing live esports events. We started repackaging the content, the normal live content that we had or had broadcasted in different ways. We started adding non-live content and felt that we built a different level of engagement with that content as well with our fans. So getting out of this, hopefully, COVID times, and we're not obviously not out of that period, but live sports is back. But it also made us think on continuing to have that mix of content, and that has built part of our future strategy as well. And for example, in esports, we were already building that strategy, but COVID has really pushed us to accelerate that, and that will become now a fundamental part of our growth strategy going forward. So I think for 11 Sports, the growth path that we are on and focusing on live is very much on how can we expand the live, can expand live to different genres, but also add new verticals like in esports, women's content, and so on, and the second tier content. And that also links to the recent acquisition we did of the Mycucho platform, which will be a big and an important part of the 11 growth strategy. And obviously being in that process, in looking with the teams and how can we improve our offering across the different countries on 11, I was already working on, you know, creating non-live content within Neo Studios business, which is a completely different way of working, different way of thinking. It's much more creative than I don't want to say that 11 Sports is not creative, because we are, but it's a different way of producing content and looking at content. And the fact that we had Neo Studios and already were doing that also gave us an opportunity to use some part of that content within the 11 ecosystem. And looking at Neo Studios going forward, obviously we did this show for Amazon and we have now a show that we are producing for Rakuten, for example. But very much we can service as well all the other companies within the Acer group, it being 11 Sports, it being our new recent service launched live now. So I think there is a very good synergy within the group, but also a great opportunity for productions outside of a group. So that's how the two kind of sit next and together, and makes it for me personally interesting to have both heads on. Because no, look at 11, looking at, you know, cash flows and operational problems. And opportunities, having that kind of more creative angle as well really makes my personal life a bit more balanced and my head a little more balanced. So I always needed both, to have both aspects in my life.
It's nice just to have that sort of 50-50. You have that exactly. You know, absolutely it does. And I think it's such a special place as well, right? To sit, you sitting in this really lovely intersection between looking on one hand at how do you really enhance a viewing experience in a live moment for when people come in for that big event, but then how do you keep people engaged with sport, which essentially feeds the viewing habit and the behavior and love of sport by going to create some really exciting, meaningful content that allows you to use more of your creative storytelling side of your brain. So I think you've got a really lovely, special symbiotic relationship there with your day-to-day roles, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
And sort of when you look at now where you are and you look at the influences that have happened to kind of mold this, you know, love for having a day-to-day job where it's kind of, let's say, more functional, strategic, mechanic versus another one where it's more creative and that sort of storytelling, exploratory. What sort of influence did your upbringing have on you in terms of veering you towards these sort of career paths? Was there one thing that happened when you were younger or as you were growing up that made you kind of occupy these spaces?
Looking how I grew up, I come from a family with a mother and a father that had their own businesses, were very much self-made people, very ambitious. And my father was a guy who, you know, when he building his business and also when us growing up, we were two girls, said, well, you can achieve anything in life. You just need to be bold and do this. And he, you know, the Disney quote, if you can dream it, you can do it, was very much his thing and how we were brought up. So he still,
I love that. Really love that.
So he stimulated us a lot. So there are no boundaries. It's up to you to, you know, make it happen. And that kind of mentality very much shaped me to become, I think, who I am. And some smaller examples, if my father was, as he said, he had his own business when he was 18 years old. He could buy his own car when he was 18 years old. And then he said, well, I'm not going to buy you a car. So if you need a car, you need to find your own way of doing it.
Do it yourself. And, I love it. He was like, get going.
And that really pushed me to do so. And I worked like 3 different jobs in weekends and actually bought my car, my first car when I was 18. And
amazing.
It was a crappy car. I didn't think I need to buy an insurance as well and gasoline.
Yeah, but you could get from A to B. You could get from A to B. That's what matters. Yeah.
So, but that shaped you. And I still have that car, by the way, because it's an important. It's a little blue Volkswagen Beetle.
I love it.
So it sits on the driveway still. But it's a symbol of, you know, if you really want to achieve something, you need to work hard, and regardless who you are,
definitely. I love that. Yeah, and, no, definitely. And it's that reminder, right? It's that reminder of success that's really tangible. And I think sometimes we don't often have enough of, and I had a guest on earlier in the series who really came up with a lovely phrase. We don't have enough trophy moments for ourselves that remind us of the milestones that we reach. And so sometimes it's easy to get lost in the everyday things when you could have your eyes really focused on an opportunity to be more like, actually, I did that. And so every day, do you think that somehow when you walk past that beetle every day, it maybe gives you that kind of intuitive feedback that you've been here before, you've done it before, this car is proof? Do you feel like that is another reason why you keep that it there for you, to give you that visible reminder of your success?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just and it's, I think it's my husband always says, well, can we please get rid of the car, because it's just sitting in and it's, you're not driving it anymore. So I still have this plan with my oldest to actually start rebuilding it and start driving.
You're gonna restore it. Amazing.
Yeah, so I'm gonna make a
when are you gonna find time to do that?
It's on my list.
It's on your list.
It's one of the things that I'm going to keep it until I find time to actually do that.
To do it. It could be a good retirement project for you in many years to come. Maybe that's what you should do. Aim for that. That could be your hobby. Yeah.
Redoing it by then.
No worries. I probably, if Andrea's listening, he'll get nervous. She's not going to retire. Don't worry. It's fine. She's still here running the show. And on that subject, obviously, with things that have been on your list, a really great milestone that you've had, you know, for such a young production company, Neo Studios, is that you've had a chance to make a really, really engaging piece of original content about one of sort of the most sort of established heritage football clubs in Leeds United. How did you find that process of creating something like a follow docu-series with Leeds? Because this has kind of been the year of the kind of team documentaries, with The Last Dance coming out, you know, on Netflix. And then, you know, we've had Sunderland Until I Die come out before with Netflix. And you were kind of sitting in between, right, of that sort of that legacy story for Leeds, but also their ambition now that they've returned to the Premier League after being 16 years out of that. How did you find that whole process? And also, you also got a chance to work with Russell Crowe. So I think a lot of people would love to hear how do you tell the story of Leeds United, which is a huge, you know, club and means so much in the history of English football, and also incorporate this big heavyweight Hollywood actor in doing that?
Yeah, it's been a very interesting process, a very challenging one by times, but it's been, you know, really fun journey, in all honesty. From the first moment that Andrea mentioned, let's do a docu-series, I said, well, and he explained the vision he had for the club, the people he got in. He obviously got Bielsa, which is an icon, to the club as well. So you immediately felt there was a lot there to tell a great story. So when you dive into that, so there is, you know, great characters that you could follow. It's a club with a lot of history. It's a city with lots of history and lots of ties within that club. The club has very passionate fans, and they have this seemingly great, almost impossible ambition to get back to the Premier League. And all those elements made us really excited about the prospect of doing that. So in that process, what we did, so we immediately felt we need to have, you know, a local director, a local team who really understands culturally the club and what it means to, you know, a community and to a city. Because we very much wanted to, there are a lot of sports documentaries out there, just not make another docu-series about sports. We really had the ambition to make it differently, not only visually differently, so make it like filmmaking, let me make sure it actually looks extremely good, but also focused on the human aspects and the human stories, not necessarily on the sports aspect of it, because, you know, everybody knows what happened during a season and has seen it or experienced it. And instead of telling a very linear story of what happened day after game and during the season, we decided to follow some key characters. And we defined them in the beginning together with the local director, who actually looked for, you know, the right fans to get in the mix. And I feel it, and I hope we succeeded at least in that, to try to tell a different sports docu-series, bring something differently, focus more on, you know, the business aspect to it, the cultural aspect of it, rather than only the, you know, locker room or the sportive aspects of the game. And obviously during that process, when you start, you don't know what's going to happen, obviously. You plan and you try to plan, and this is like a continuous process while you're shooting, and you have your key characters, but, you know, during your shooting there are new ones popping up, other ones that doesn't really fit,
that you didn't anticipate, and then you start to grow a little bit more you can understand that the audience will start to sort of love their story, and so it's how do you then fit them in and balance that with the kind of roadmap you'd set out.
Yeah, and you throw away a lot of stuff that you think, well, you only, and that's the most difficult part, because there's so many stories, and then you try to keep the best ones. And obviously, Leeds had the first season was, well, we couldn't have scripted what happened during that season, which was great. So we had Spygate. Yeah, we had transfers going wrong. And then we had obviously the dramatic ending of the first season, which was very painful for the club, the fans, and everybody involved from a documentary point of view, but also because it shows really the passion of the fans and all the people involved in Leeds, from the management to you know, the ticket lady, and the passion for the club, but also the resilience in saying, we didn't make it, but we go again. We can do this, and that I think was a very, very beautiful moment, end of season one, and then obviously moving into season two. COVID hit, and then it became a whole different kind of practical journey. But the end, actually taking Leeds home in this series, was the best thing ever, and. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed making this series.
Definitely. And I you can definitely see that sort of local owned perspective that comes through in how the characters are concentrated on, and I think in particular how the fan perspective is relayed through the doc. And it really reminded me, it had a lot of real great synergies, I think, with the sort of, let's say, the connected human stories around the club and the community. It really reminded me a lot of how Sunderland and Till I Die was also told that story, because Sunderland's also, you know, a club that's very much at the heart of the community, in much the same way as Leeds is, and has had a really, really proud fan base who've had real, you know, moments of high and real moments of low that have been so publicly, you know, reported and scrutinized. And so how did you decide creatively? You obviously had that as your sort of anchoring point to relaying the story and capturing every character, but then obviously you had this narrator in Russell Crowe. So how did you decide to match those things up? Because intuitively speaking to a lot of people, when they see that, they'll be like, oh, Russell Crowe, huge like Hollywood actor of Gladiator fame, what has he got to do with the lead story? So how did you come to bringing him into the picture?
Yeah, when we at the beginning of the process decided that we needed to have a narrator to tell the story, to guide actually the viewer through the events of the season. When we thought about who could be a good voice, we didn't just want to have like any, you know, Hollywood name or big name tied to the project. It needed to make sense from a content perspective. And Russell, and maybe not a lot of people know that, is a huge Leeds fan. He absolutely loves the club. When he was younger, he discovered when Leeds was big at the time, and he watched Match of the Day with his younger brother. He became a Leeds fan,
Amazing.
And so from a content perspective, it made sense to have a voice on it who actually love the club as much as everybody else in that series. And that's the reason why we had Russell Crowe as number one on our list. And I didn't want to, you know, get from option B or C or D. So I really wanted to have Russell Crowe.
I mean, if you get a chance to have Russell Crowe, I mean, you definitely want to take that opportunity, right?
Yeah, but it was a challenge to get him in. Not he immediately bought into the project, obviously because he loves Leeds. He said, "Well, this is great, and I want to do this." But from a practical point of view, it wasn't the easiest thing to pull off because, obviously, he is a very busy actor, has a lot of things to do. And we had a very short time frame where we could do the voice, because obviously when you start filming and you start assembling the episodes towards the end of the season, you need to finalize all the episodes, the scripts need to be written, and then you need to deliver to Amazon in a very short time frame. So there was only a very small window where we could have him record something. At the moment in time, that window really didn't fit. So in the end, so it took a lot of going back and forth, and we actually ended up booking a studio in the US. I think it was in New Orleans, where he was shooting a movie. Grabbed him in between shooting days and put him in a studio to record the voice. So that was the only window we had.
Wow.
Yeah. So we had no time to fly over our director, and Russell Crowe basically said, "Well, I didn't need Ridley Scott, so I can do without a director." So, and he recorded it.
True.
And he recorded it, and so we were.
And did you find that process?
Sorry.
Sorry to interrupt you. I was asking, how did you find the process of coaching him to record the lines with feeling? Because were you sending him the footage so he could watch? How did you manage to get him in the moment of being able to narrate it? Or was it intuitive to him because obviously he's a fan and has followed the season? How did you manage to get him in those moments to be able to really match with them?
So we had sent him all rough cuts, materials beforehand, so he had time to watch it. We sent over the scripts, we made some notes on the scripts from the director as well to make sure that he understood where we were going, and that was it. I think he just got in the studio and we were just sitting in Leeds waiting for the voice to come in, hoping that it would be good, because if it wasn't, then there was no time to do it again. And it was absolutely brilliant. It was spot on. He really got, from what we edited and from the notes he got, it just fitted perfectly. We just literally just had to drop it on the video and it was done. But obviously he's a great professional, and being a Leeds fan, I think he felt the same thing that our director felt when putting together the show. So that was great.
Yeah. No, definitely. And I think you can also hear, for me, it was interesting to get a watch because I got to binge watch them back to back. So what was really interesting was to see also his genuine emotion at the end of season two, when you kind of reached it after the heartbreak of season one. I think that brings back to that authenticity of the storytelling that you captured really nicely.
Yeah, and he did some variations at the end of season two. So he said, "This is the script," and then he sent over some additional files and said, "Well, we are all Leeds, aren't we?" And it's like, so he did some specific text. We didn't use them. We used the best ones, but he got like really creative at the end and saying, "Well, maybe you should use this
one."
The best thing. So it's. So he got off script there at the end.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say off script, but it's the passion of the football fan in him maybe took over.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you genuinely enjoy these kind of big stretch projects where you have these challenges where, you know, you have to wrangle big Hollywood stars together with balancing a football club like Leeds that has the ambition and the sort of let's say complexities of operating in such a competitive, high performing league? Is that where you feel the most alive when you're doing projects like that?
Yeah, to be honest, I really do like, you know, running that kind of shows and looking for, you know, the best people to tell a story and then be involved in, you know, every step of the way and saying, well, does the story go left and the story go right? Having that kind of discussions really gives me a lot of energy, to be honest. So I really love doing that. And as I said in the beginning, I think I need that balance in my head as well to keep sane, mm-hmm. I think, in these times, so that's really helpful.
Yeah, and what other sort of, because, you know, let's sort of putting myself in sort of a lot of people's shoes, I'm sure they'll be listening to this and be incredibly in awe of all the great things you've done. What are, if you were to sort of whittle it down, what are the things that anchor you to be able to believe in yourself and do this work? Because it's you straddle two worlds there where you are very much in the minority as a female, right? Both in the sports side, mm-hmm. at a C-suite level, and both in the production film original making side as an MD. So what is it about you that keeps you going when you're meeting those challenges? Because there's quite a lot of challenges that come when you're in those highly visible positions of leadership. What keeps you motivated to address those challenges and to believe in yourself?
Well, personally, I've always done it in every job I had in the past. I think you need to be, for yourself, be very visual on what you want to achieve. What I mean by that is you write down, literally write down on, you know, some goals you have, and you look at that every morning, and this can be like completely at first sight unachievable goals, but if you Alice in Wonderland, I love the quote, if sometimes I think of six impossible things before breakfast, I think that's something that
I like that.
You need to keep in mind. So, and I have a list with seemingly impossible things, but I have that list and I look at it almost every morning and say, well, if times get difficult, I think there are more impossible things. Basically, are no impossible things to be done. So I try to keep that in mind with every challenge you see, and same for every problem, there is a solution, and you need to find a solution within yourself. And that's have been driving me in whatever job I did, if it's being in the magazine business, in a telco business, in our production business. So I've been in several types of businesses, but the principles are all the same. And I think as being a woman in business and in sports, I always find that you need to think about play big. If you want to do something, just do it big and do it well, and just not half. So and you need to listen to, you know, your inner voice, your inner mentor to keep telling you, think big.
Yeah. And what have you had points of motivation, people who've allowed you to be able to stay really anchored to those visualizations of those goals, as well as, you know, obviously, as you say, think big and do big. Have they been influences in your professional career that have allowed you to be able to stay really rooted at that?
Yeah, I've met during my career a lot of interesting people, interesting CEOs who I loved working with, and who really help you keep that focus and give, you know, a framework, either from a strategic point of view, but also from a creative point of view. If I look at somebody like Andrea, for example, he is like a serial entrepreneur. He's extremely creative, he's extremely focused, knows what he wants to do, and has lots of ideas, but that's a great thing as well. But I think from that point of view, it's a gift to have somebody in your environment. But I had that even at my first job. When I left university, I started freelancing for a headhunter company. And the owner of that company actually became a great friend. And when I started my own company 2 years after, I asked him to, you know, sit on the board just as a mentor. And so getting close to that kind of people, he really brought a lot to me, not on only on a business level, but on a personal level, on you know, how to grow yourself and how to think and how to stop and reflect. And he's, this guy was great, and we're still friends. But helped me a lot in being at the young age, giving a bit guidance. And I think it's important to find these kind of people during your career and during your life. Definitely. Because they're so important, and I currently have a network of a few very good friends who work in media as well, and when it gets tough, we just get now on a Zoom call and just talk and reflect and support each other, and that has always been something that I have been looking for, and I've been fortunate to find, to be honest.
No, I think it makes a huge difference. And I think also what's so interesting to hear from you, and as well, I've also heard from other women, has been the role that, you know, having really strong male allies has had in giving you guys a platform to grow and accelerate and achieve your full potential. You know, it's that ability. I always say, even though in the sports industry, women, we're in the minority, what can be really, really positive and impactful for bringing more women to have opportunities like you, having seats at the table, running companies, driving them on, is having strong male professional allies who see that a woman has great potential and actually enables her to achieve that, rather than sort of holding them back in the sort of, we don't know what might happen if we have more women coming in. It's that we need that sort of ability for men to understand how much more they can do to also help boost the profile and progression of women in sport.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me personally, it all started at the beginning with my father, with his two girls, saying you can achieve anything. So
I was about to say, and that influence has shaped you and has allowed you to lean more into those sort of characters that have enabled that early way of believing in yourself and growing that your father instilled in you and your sisters, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And now when you're sort of, you know, you're a mom as well as all the other extraordinary things you do, if you were to sort of sit down and kind of give some sort of life advice to your kids, as well as to other, lots of other women and men who will be listening in, of sort of the career defining moments or projects that you've done, what sort of lessons would you take from that to give them to set them up in a really good way in the way your father did for you?
Yeah, I have two boys, and I think the most important thing I need to teach them is, you know, to find their own passion and find their own path, and give them the confidence to do that. And I just want, I'm a mom that gives them a lot of freedom, and I want them to have a lot of freedom to think and to find it, but I also push them a bit to, you know, to do better and to reach for that additional step. But also in our family, and I have been very busy over the, you know, obviously the last couple of years when them growing up as well, and they're still rather young. I have the luxury also to have a husband who was at home a lot and make sure that, you know.
Oh, nice.
We had a great balance in you know, that's being a mother, having my job, still feeling that my kids have a warm home to grow up in, but also gives them, and I think that's maybe the most important part, a framework of how women and men arrange things and work in business.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if I can teach my boys that women can do whatever they want, and when they have their wives and their girlfriends one day, at least I hope that shapes them to have that mindset as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's seeing that everyday role model of seeing a really healthy gender balance relationship that is not sort of falling into quite problematic stereotypes that, you know, we've long had as a society, that, oh, you know, mom stays at home and raises the kids all on her own and, you know, makes the sacrifices around career. But instead, seeing how you share that parenting role and it's very much a partnership is such a positive thing for them to grow up around.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah, you're very modest. I'm sure it is. And shout out to your husband for being so supportive and giving you the abilities and the support that, you know, that you need as a partnership to be successful. And if you were to give another lesson that you've sort of observed from your lived experience or your professional life. It doesn't have to be sort of like a huge defining thing. It could be maybe even something you've learned in, you know, setting up 11 Sport in the Benelux region. It's been something that you've learned and observed, or maybe it could be something in this moment as sport looks to reshape itself and try to maintain relevance.
Yeah, I think it even the most difficult thing, I think, in these times is to give them, you know, a sort of a resilience against setbacks. It's something that in general I worry about, because kids growing up now, they need to do a lot. The future is probably tough, and these are tough times for them as well. And how do you mentally make sure you're ready to cope with that, to any setback that you will get? And that's very much something that I just want to teach them is you'll experience setbacks, and you'll have problems, and but everything can, not everything, but most of it can be overcome, and give them the strength to find that in themselves to do so. I think that's in personal life, in business, you need that, and I hope I can help them teach a bit of that, of give them a bit of that strength growing up, because I know this generation will isn't easy for them. So so I hope.
Yeah, no, it's definitely the
that I can give them.
Yeah, there's a lesson there to be learned, I think, for everyone, not just, you know, young people around. How do you set up your mindset to be able to accept that not everything you do will be a great success, but understanding that it's worth trying and being brave, you know, in jumping off that ledge and knowing that, you know, might not land exactly how I want to, but it's worth to do, right? Because you learn a lot of lessons even from setbacks. I've found myself in life that I've learned a lot more in the moments when I've failed at something than when I've succeeded. I've definitely been able to pause and take a lot more from those moments.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And just sort of, you know, when you're looking back, you know, after you have, and I'm sure you'll have so much to look back on with all the great projects that you're doing now and have done in the past. Do you have an idea of what your North Star is? Like, what would your legacy be? What would you love to hear somebody say about you when you decide to retire and go and look after, restore your Volkswagen, your Beetle? What is it that you would love to be able to know that you had left behind?
A very nice restored Beetle.
Apart from the nice restored Beetles.
No, I think legacy is a very heavy and big word. I think for me personally, in everything I've done, I've just tried to, you know, do the best I can, work, do the best for the people I worked with, and if anything, I hope people that have worked with just will look back and thought it was a difficult time to work with me, and just I don't have any big things that I want to leave behind. I think my biggest achievement will be my children and having them growing up to, you know, balanced adults. That will be the most important part.
Yeah, I love that. I love that the woman who lives by the motto of doing everything big just simply wants to have a life less ordinary. But I don't think you will, Anouk, because you are doing a lot of really extraordinary things. And I think your legacy will definitely be inspiring people, that you've forged a lot of great paths of being the first, but certainly not the last in those positions. So thank you very much for making the time to talk us through all the great work that you're doing and have done, and your life lessons. And I hope to get a chance to meet you face to face at some point when when we can return to some semblance of normal. I don't even know if you can call it normal anymore. I don't know. But thank you.
We will.
Exactly. It definitely. But we must get together and keep us posted on all your projects. And thank you to everybody for tuning in to another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely impressive Anouk Merton.
Thank you.
Thank you.